List at KAXE.org. We continue with Morning Edition.
Good morning. President Trump now says Republicans should vote to release the Epstein files. We hear from Annie Farmer, one of Epstein's accusers, who has flown to Washington for the vote in the House. That's ahead on Morning Edition from NPR News. A former Meta executive revisits its sudden shift to follow President Trump. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Nick Clegg suggests a big company should stay on its own course. He also warns against the fragmentation of the global internet. Also, how does a corruption scandal affect the reputation of Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky? And how can people clean up the Ohio River? It's Monday, November 17th. This day in 1973, President Richard Nixon said people should know if their president is a crook and, quote, "I'm not a crook." The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. President Trump has reversed course. Writing online yesterday, he's now telling Republican lawmakers to vote for a measure calling on the Justice Department to release all files on late sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. Speaking aboard Air Force One earlier, Trump dismissed the Epstein files as a Democratic hoax to hurt Republicans.
They're using Jeffrey Epstein as a deflection from the tremendous success that we're having as a party.
But a bipartisan group of lawmakers in the House already has enough support to force a vote on the release of the files. That vote is expected sometime this week. Last hour, the Federal Aviation Administration lifted all restrictions on air travel in the U.S. imposed during the federal government shutdown. Air traffic had been reduced by up to 6% last week. That was due to growing staff shortages among air traffic controllers. NPR has learned that a former top Justice Department official told a group of prosecutors last February that the administration should target drug traffickers at sea. Former acting Deputy Attorney General Emile Beauvais told the prosecutors that the U.S. should, quote, "just sink the boats." 6 months later, the U.S. began blowing up boats in the Caribbean and Eastern Pacific. Venezuela's president says his country wants peace. This comes as the U.S. boosts its military presence in the Caribbean. President Trump says the Venezuelan leader has signaled he wants to talk with the U.S. NPR's Kerry Kahn reports.
President Trump has been weighing military options against Venezuela. He says discussion with Venezuela President Nicolas Maduro may be coming and that the Venezuelans, quote, "would like to talk." Over the weekend, the U.S.'s most advanced aircraft carrier arrived in the Caribbean, joining nearly a dozen other U.S. naval warships there. In Venezuela, Maduro repeatedly called for peace at a rally over the weekend and on state TV praying with religious leaders. On social media, leading opponent Maria Corina Machado urged Maduro's security apparatus to lay down its arms and join her independence movement. Kerry Kahn, NPR News, Bogota, Colombia.
Hundreds of National Guard troops will be leaving Portland and Chicago in coming days. The move was ordered by the Defense Department amid court battles stalling the deployments. From member station KQED, Rachel Vasquez reports on California Governor Gavin Newsom's response.
Newsom's office confirmed the news, saying the troops' return was long overdue. President Trump federalized the troops over the summer, originally sending them to respond to immigration protests in Los Angeles. In October, Trump attempted to deploy Guard members from California to Portland as the city saw protests outside of immigration enforcement offices. A federal judge in Oregon ruled against the deployment last week. For NPR News, I'm Rachel Vasquez in Sacramento.
You're listening to NPR News from Washington. The U.S. Border Patrol fanned out over the weekend in Charlotte, North Carolina. Agency leaders say they have arrested dozens of people and claim they are violent criminals. No evidence has been formally presented. Some Charlotte business owners closed their businesses, while other Charlotte residents say the Border Patrol targeted American citizens in stores. Pennsylvania Democratic Senator John Fetterman has returned home after a brief hospital stay. He said he had a flare-up of a heart issue and fell while walking. Fetterman says he has recovered but had to get 20 stitches. Stargazers may have noticed bright streaks high in the sky overnight. It's the Leonid meteor shower. NPR's Chandelise Duster reports it will continue through tomorrow morning.
The Leonid meteor shower happens every November. The meteors are known to be bright, colorful, and very fast, traveling at 44 miles per second. Meteor rates are as low as 3 meteors per hour, but NASA says stargazers can catch up to 10 to 15 meteors per hour this year. The best chances of seeing the meteors will be after midnight and into the early morning hours. The American Meteor Society says to go to a dark location away from city lights and look to the eastern sky and the constellation Leo. Meteors will be seen streaking from there in various directions. The moon will also be less than 10% full, making it easier to see the Leonids. Chandelise Duster, NPR News.
On Wall Street in pre-market trading, Dow futures are up slightly. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping those in need is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at LodestarFoundation.org. This is NPR.
I found a song.
So I found KAXE when I was in college here in Bemidji. I actually can remember being at the stoplights at Dave's Pizza, just jumping radio stations, and it must have been, I want to say it was the Jayhawks, maybe Wilco was on the radio, and it floored me. I was like, wait, how am I hearing this in Bemidji, in northern Minnesota? I thought I had to be in the Twin Cities to get this stuff.
Mark is a member of KAXE. We are people powered. The music that you hear is not chosen by the government or an algorithm or a corporation. It's chosen by your friends and neighbors. Over 70 hours a week is produced by local volunteers. Support the people of northern Minnesota and KAXE with your donation now. Go to KAXE.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep in Washington, D.C.
And I'm A. Martinez in Culver City, California. President Trump abruptly reversed his opinion about a vote on the Epstein files.
He now says he is in favor of a vote to release information about the convicted sex offender who was his friend for years. The president and his allies in Congress resisted this vote for months. But after many Republicans appeared ready to join Democrats in voting against Trump, the president said he approves and, quote, "We have nothing to hide." We hear from one of Epstein's accusers, Annie Farmer, right after we get up to date on the facts.
NPR's Luke Garrett is with us. Trump is now telling Republicans they should vote to tell him to act. Luke, why change now?
Yeah, that's right. And we need to go back a few days to better understand this move and this moment. Last week, Representatives Thomas Massie of Kentucky, a Republican, and Ro Khanna of California, a Democrat, gathered 218 signatures. That's enough to force a vote on the release of the DOJ documents regarding the late convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. And a source familiar but not authorized to share the House schedule publicly confirmed that Speaker Johnson would bring this vote up on Tuesday. This teed up a really difficult vote for Republicans who had to decide whether to vote with Trump and against the bill or vote to release the Epstein files. And this was also tough for Trump himself, who faced, you know, dozens of potential defectors.
All right, so if the vote is on Tuesday, why did Trump make this Sunday late night announcement?
Well, in a social media post last night, Trump said he wanted the GOP to move on from what he called the Democratic hoax and distraction. And notably, on the Sunday morning news shows, two House Republicans publicly and loudly rebuked Trump over the Epstein files. On ABC News, Massie took a warning shot against Trump's legacy and any GOP member willing to vote against this bill.
In 2030, he's not going to be the president, and you will have voted to protect pedophiles if you don't vote to release these files, and the president can't protect you.
Massie then said he believed 100 or more House Republicans would vote for the Epstein file bill, even though only a handful signed on to force the ballot.
Wasn't one of them Georgia Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene?
Yeah, that's right. And Trump recently called her a traitor and revoked his political endorsement from her after she became more critical of his policies. When asked why she and Trump had this falling out, Green told CNN,
"Unfortunately, it has all come down to the Epstein files, and that is shocking."
Now, both Massey and Green said they don't believe Trump himself will be implicated in the files, but these public breaks with the president represented a growing and powerful fissure in the party.
Okay, so now that Trump is telling all Republicans to vote for the Epstein file bill, what happens now?
Well, my sources say the House vote is still set for Tuesday, and with Trump giving Republicans permission to support it and every Democrat signing the discharge petition, this bill has a really good chance of advancing. In the Senate, it remains unclear if and when Majority Leader John Thune will bring this up for a vote. But again, Trump's endorsement of the bill, you know, does not hurt, and Thune has said in the last few weeks, you know, he likes this idea of greater transparency. But even if it passes through Congress and the White House, lawmakers Massey and Khanna were warning yesterday that the files might still be kept from the public.
So after all that, how could that be possible?
Well, Massey and Khanna raised alarm over the new Justice Department investigation into the Epstein case, something it declined to do a few months back. Trump referenced this in his post last night. He said his DOJ is, quote, looking at various Democrat operatives, Bill Clinton, Reid Hoffman, Larry Summers, etc., and their relationships to Epstein, end quote. Massey told ABC News that these investigations could mask the documents further.
If they have ongoing investigations in certain areas, those documents can't be released. So this might be a big smokescreen.
The Justice Department has not yet responded to my request for comment on whether an investigation would in fact bar them from releasing these documents, even if a law told them to do so.
That's NPR's Luke Garrett. Luke, thanks a lot.
You bet.
We hear next from Annie Farmer, one of many people who testified against Jeffrey Epstein and his partner Ghislaine Maxwell. She told her story about being abused at Epstein's New Mexico ranch when she was 16. She used her full name at a bail hearing for Epstein and again at Maxwell's criminal trial. She is now here in Washington for this week's House vote, and she is here in Studio 31. Good morning. Thanks for coming by.
Good morning.
What is this moment like for you to be ready for this vote after all this time?
It's a bit surreal, honestly, to be here now with so much attention and so much momentum. But it's also, you know, hearing the news the way it's unfolding and feeling like there's more and more pressure to finally have the transparency we've been asking for feels really good.
Just a few days ago, it appeared that the White House was pressuring Republican lawmakers to turn against this vote, to take their names off a petition if they could. And suddenly last night, the president says, go ahead and vote for it. What do you think of that about face?
I think there's a healthy amount of skepticism amongst those of us who have been involved in this fight for a long time. You know, there have been so many efforts to, I'd say, politicize this and obfuscate the truth that I hope that that is the case and that everyone's on the same page that this would be the best thing for the American people. But, I think that remains to be seen.
Is it a little strange here? The resolution that the president is now in favor of, I guess, would not have the force of law. It would have to still pass the Senate. It would have to be signed by the president. But the documents, so far as we know, are in the Justice Department that the president very strictly controls. What do you want the president to do?
I think we're all very clear. We want all of the files released. I am concerned that, you know, creating a new active investigation would potentially, you know, give them the excuse of holding back certain files. And I think that would be very problematic because, again, we have seen this kind of, trickling of information coming out. And I think that's really hard on us. It means that this continues on and on. We want all of the files released.
You just said an interesting thing, referring to another statement of the president at the end of last week. He said, wait a minute, I want to investigate the Democrats, instructed the Justice Department to investigate not him, because his name has turned up hundreds of times in files, but Democrats who've been named, Bill Clinton, Larry Summers, the former Treasury Secretary, on and on, a major Democratic donor, some other people. It sounds like you're skeptical of that demand for an investigation, which the Justice Department is obeying.
Yes. I think, you know, what we have continued to say is this is not partisan. There, you know, when my sister Maria Farmer first reported, she was really the initial whistleblower on this case in 1996. She talked to the FBI, right? That was during the Clinton administration. We have had problems occur in this case during almost every administration. There have been you know, failures over and over again. And that's why we have really, my sister actually filed a lawsuit against the federal government because of their failures, their negligence, you know, to do the right thing in this case. And so, you know, that's why she did that. That's why we've all come together to say very clearly, bring this out of the shadows. We need full transparency. We don't want excuses about holding certain things back.
When the Justice Department initially said several months ago, we're not releasing any more information, nothing more to see here, whatever we may have, there's no public use in releasing it. Is it possible that they were correct, that there isn't any more information than what's already in the public domain?
No, that's really not possible.
Go on. Why do you think that?
I mean, I think even what we've seen, right, coming out recently with the work of the House Oversight Committee, right, I think there's certain things there that are that have come to light that the American public has a lot of interest in knowing and understanding. And it's also, you know, there's a piece about accountability, wanting people that not just participated in these crimes, but also that allowed them, that funded them, you know, that looked the other way. I think there's a reckoning for all of that that needs to happen. And so this idea that, no, there's nothing more to see here, we don't buy it.
I guess there have been details that I didn't know in recent days. The idea that Epstein was collaborating with a member of Congress, asking questions about this at one point. The closeness of Larry Summers with Epstein and his wife, going back and forth with very intimate discussions. More than 1,000 mentions of the President of the United States in these files, among other things.
Yeah.
I want to go into one other matter here, if I can, that I feel is important to raise, if possible. Megyn Kelly, mm-hmm. Prominent. You're nodding. You know what
yes.
I'm going to ask about. I'm going to lay it out here for people who are not familiar. Megyn Kelly, very prominent podcast host, former Fox News host, has been talking about this and in recent days tried to draw a distinction between abusing a teenager, someone 16, 17, and abusing an 8-year-old. Mm-hmm. You have testified that you were abused at the age of 16 at Epstein's New Mexico ranch. Do you see a distinction between an 8-year-old and a 16-year-old?
No. I think that it's incredibly problematic the way that she is trying to minimize crimes against people that are under the law considered children, right? She actually used the term barely legal to describe a 15-year-old, which is completely
inaccurate.
Actually
illegal, yes.
Yeah, that is illegal. And I think it's just part of a campaign because they have not been able to get rid of this, maybe trying to say, well, really, this wasn't so bad. And I think that's horrifying. It sends a very dangerous message to young people in this country that, you know, that if something happened to them, they would not be, it wouldn't be considered a crime. That is wrong.
One other thing I want to ask about before I let you go, Democratic Congressman Jamie Raskin of Maryland has given evidence, says that a whistleblower has come forward and given evidence to the House Judiciary Committee of special treatment for Ghislaine Maxwell in prison, including customized meals, playtime with a service dog, access to prison exercise areas, other things. You testified against Maxwell. What do you think of the way she's being treated in prison?
It's disturbing. Yeah, I'm in contact with another woman that testified in that trial as well. And, you know, when we hear these things come out, I think we're horrified, you know, and it makes me think about people who are not here, people like Virginia Giuffre, you know, whose recent memoir has gotten so much attention. And she so clearly describes how Maxwell was very pivotal in the abuse that occurred. And there's another woman who testified in that trial who lost her life since that trial. Mm. And I think because of the complications of trauma that she endured. And so it's really, really upsetting to think that she would somehow be escaping her punishment that that very much deserves.
Annie Farmer is here in Studio 31. She's here in Washington as the House of Representatives prepares to vote on a resolution urging the release of the Epstein files. Thanks so much for your time. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
This is NPR News.
It's 19 minutes after 6 o'clock. Good morning. Thanks for listening to KAXE and the Monday Morning Show. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up at 6:30, Minnesota Native News. This week, we'll hear about a new art exhibition honoring Two-Spirit individuals and a new inductee into the Minnesota Lacrosse Hall of Fame. Then Laura Erickson will be speaking for the Birds. We'll hear a book review of a new edition of the National Geographic Guide. Support for KAXE comes from the First State Bank of Big Fork, with branches in Big Fork and Kellyer, offering tools for managing money on any mobile device. Hometown banking at its best since 1912, fsbbigfork.com, member FDIC. We also thank ICTV. Stay tuned, stay connected with ICTV. Learn more at watchictv.org. Mostly sunny today with highs in the upper 30s, winds from the north around 5 miles per hour. Tonight, partly cloudy, lows in the upper teens, and mostly sunny tomorrow with highs in the mid-30s. Support comes from Minnesota Power, an elite company powering the region's homes, business, and industry since 1923. Learn more about its vision of a carbon-free future at mmpower.com/energyforward. The United Way of Bemidji area's Holiday Gifts for Kids program is now accepting new unwrapped gifts for those aged newborn through 17. Donations may be dropped at several locations in Bemidji now until December 8th. Find more information and registration forms for families at unitedwaybemidji.org.
NPR comes from this station and from Storyworth. Each week, Storyworth emails a loved one a question about their life. After a year, Storyworth will publish their stories and color photos into a book to keep for generations. Learn more at storyworth.com. From Fisher Investments, Fisher's dedicated team of specialists provide resources on investing, retirement income, estate planning, and more. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. And from Easy Cater, committed to helping organizations order and manage food for all their business needs. With online ordering from restaurants nationwide, employee meal programs, and tools to control food expenses. At EasyCater.com.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Our next guest has had a career like few others. Nick Clegg was Deputy Prime Minister of the UK and then became President of Global Affairs at Meta, a close aide to company founder Mark Zuckerberg. He's now written of his experience in a book called How to Save the Internet. Clegg left Meta at the start of this year, just as Zuckerberg and other tech leaders were heading to President Trump's second inauguration.
Many of them, of course, lined up in front of the members of the cabinet. So it was as if the tech leadership of Silicon Valley was being given greater priority than the political leadership of the new administration.
At almost the same time, Meta decided to abandon fact-checking on social media posts aligning with an administration that disliked it. Clegg says he understands the tech world's sudden shift to Trump after years when they seemed to favor Democrats or despised politics altogether.
And I guess that's partly driven by the fact that a lot of these big companies are in a bit of an existential competition with each other on AI. So, of course, in that context, if you see your neighbor or the leader of your, you know, most competitive opponent in Silicon Valley beating a path to Mar-a-Lago or Washington, D.C., you think, oh, well, I better do the same thing as well. I don't want to be left out. So I think there was a kind of FOMO thing going on where if one or two of them were doing that, they all ended up doing that.
Is that why Meta shifted its stance on content moderation at that very moment?
Well, I think it may have played a part of it. I think, to be fair, there is a perception, which I don't think is wholly wrong for what it's worth, that maybe the companies, including Meta, and even at my time at Meta, that maybe we overdid it a bit and we needed to pull back on some of that. And I don't think you can criticize the companies or criticize Meta for adjusting, because, you know, it's not a science, and the boundaries of free expression versus content moderation have become a much more politicized subject in the last half decade or so. But I would have thought in the long run, it is in all of their interests not to embark on this kind of whiplash, you know, where they keep changing their stance depending on who's in the White House. In the long run, given the significance of these companies, I would have thought it's best for them to be able to kind of have a bit of a North Star themselves and stick to it, or stick roughly to it, rather than swinging, like a yo-yo from one side to the other.
I'm thinking back to 2021 when Facebook and other social media platforms banned President Trump in the aftermath of the January 6th attacks. And I can remember thinking at the time as a journalist trying to understand this. Okay, I get it. I understand why they did that. But wow, do I really want a corporation to have that much power?
Right.
I mean, I could feel the dilemma then.
Right.
Looking back at it now, was Meta wrong to ban the president at that time?
So I was very involved. In fact, I was instrumental and key in making that decision on behalf of, as it was then, Facebook. You get an uneasy feeling having an unelected entity, one of these tech companies, deciding that an outgoing president of the United States had forfeited the right to use Facebook's services. On the other hand, it is equally troubling to think that just because someone is powerful, they can violate the rules, because all of these companies, including Meta, have quite well-established and well-publicized content rules about what you can and can't do on the platform. But I think many people felt at the time the circumstances were quite exceptional, all the turbulence and unrest. And that was a principle which the company acted on at the time.
So would you say you stand by that decision even today, even though the company ultimately backed off and paid the president for it?
I believe in the circumstances at the time, it was a decision that I took and others took in the company for understandable reasons, because content rules of Meta were violated. But I definitely feel very uneasy about the precedent that a decision like that set, for sure.
You talk about democratic countries working together to regulate the internet. You call it a digital democracies alliance. What exactly is it that you want them to regulate that is possible to regulate?
At the moment, we're seeing the growing fragmentation, the balkanization of the internet itself. And it's now, I think, colliding with the deglobalization of politics everywhere, whether it's Modi, whether it's Erdogan, whether it's Trump, whether it's Brexit, or governments everywhere are trying to reassert their own political sovereignty over things which otherwise escape their jurisdiction, notably the internet. Mm-hmm. And that will increasingly lead to a fragmented internet. So my assertion in the book is that if we want to preserve the openness of the internet that we all take for granted, at least outside China, there has to be a deliberate decision by the three major techno-democracies in the world, the United States, India, and Europe, in that sort of descending order of importance, to create new rules of the road, new guardrails, particularly pertinent to artificial intelligence, so that the openness, so open data flows, for instance, which are the main sort of arteries of the internet, remain open in the years ahead, so that there is transparency in the way in which these AI models are assembled, so that science is shared across the democratic world on how you invest in AI infrastructure and make it as sustainable as possible.
I'm fascinated just now, if I understood you correctly, you ranked India as more important than the entirety of Europe when it comes to internet issues.
I do, actually. I think that if India were to swing in a Chinese direction, if I can put it crudely like that,
Understood.
In other words, if Modi or whoever succeeds him were to decide, do you know what? India is easily big enough. It's the biggest democracy in the world. We can do what the Chinese have done, which is basically wall off the internet and surveil people within the country. I think if that were the case, then the global internet as we know it would basically be dead. So it's one of the reasons why I think the mishandling of Modi by this Trump administration seems so spectacularly misjudged, because driving Modi into the embrace of his erstwhile opponent, Xi Jinping, if I was in the State Department now, that would send a real chill down my spine, I tell you, because if India aligns with China in the AI age, then US leadership will, over time, erode.
This is a mischievous way to put the question, but I'll do it. Are you then an internet globalist?
Yes, I am, unapologetically so.
Nick Clegg is the author of How to Save the Internet. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
Parts of Florida are still recovering 3 years after Hurricane Ian swept across the state. Rising home insurance costs are making it more expensive to live in harm's way.
Little by little, you're going to see everybody going away. Anybody that don't have that money, people are going to have to move.
I'm Elsa Chang. The challenges facing Florida homeowners and renters on All Things Considered from NPR News.
You can hear All Things Considered starting at 4 o'clock today here on People Powered KAXE. Your local host will be Andrew DeZingle. Good morning. It is 6:29. I'm Jennifer Barr. Thanks so much for listening to the Monday morning show. Our weather for today, sunny, highs 38 to 42, winds from the southeast, just light southeast winds. And tonight, partly cloudy, low 17 to 25. For tomorrow, mostly sunny, highs in the low 40s. And looking ahead to Wednesday, cloudy, highs near 40, just a slight chance of rain in the afternoon. For our question of the week, our Season Watch podcast explores nature as the seasons change. How do you change when fall turns to winter? Could be those practical things, or maybe just more, how do you change? How does your mood change? Coming up in just a moment, we will have Minnesota Native News. This week, a new art exhibition honoring two-spirit individuals and a new inductee to the Minnesota Lacrosse Hall of Fame. And then we'll be hearing Laura Erickson speaking for The Bird. She's going to give us a book review on the new edition of the National Geographic Guide. Support for KAXE comes from Escape by the Lake on Paul Bunyan Drive in Bemidji, offering immersive themed experiences where teams work together to solve puzzles and find clues to escape within the hour. Learn more about the different themed rooms at escapebythelake.com. The Arrowhead Library System presents Songs of Misabi, a musical journey through the Iron Range with Greg Taberzi. Now through December 10th, you can find a list of dates, times, and locations at ALSLIB.info. It's time for Minnesota Native News.
You're listening to Minnesota Native News. I'm Murray Rock. This week, we take a look at a new art exhibit honoring two-spirit individuals, and we hear from one of the inductees for the Minnesota Lacrosse Hall of Fame. First, producer Deanna Standing Cloud stopped by Queering Indigeneity, an exhibit at the Minnesota Museum of American Art.
For Indigenous people in Minnesota, two-spirit relatives have long been held in high regard. They often served as spiritual healers, community leaders, and carried a great social influence. Across Native communities today, there's a powerful resurgence, and many are reclaiming and celebrating the teachings of the Two-Spirit Society.
When Two-Spirit people are standing in their power and they understand their gifts and they bring their gifts forward and they bring that medicine into the community, that's when tribal communities are going to thrive.
Penny Kagagabe is a citizen of the White Earth Band of Ojibwe and lead curator for the exhibit Queering Indigeneity at the Minnesota Museum of American Art in St. Paul, also known as the M.
I'm a community activist. I'm a longtime queer activist, and that's all kind of just kind of come together in this community collaboration for Two-Spirit cultural reclamation that grew and became this exhibit, Queering Indigeneity.
Nearly 500 visitors attended that day, including Dr. Kate Bean, executive director of the M.
From my understanding, I'm one of the first executive directors of an American art museum to be Native. I entered the field in order to change it.
Dr. Kate Bean is a citizen of the Flandreau Santee Dakota. She is also a local historian and researcher of Dakota history.
We're an organization that's been around since the 1890s. We actually started as a school, the St. Paul School of Fine Arts. And the organization was started by some neighborhood arts enthusiasts and supporters who at that point in time didn't look like us.
For Indigenous people in Minnesota, honoring the Two-Spirit community is vital.
I think the only way to survive right now is to lean into relationships and to remember who we are. And that's where this exhibition is so beautiful to be coming out right now.
The exhibit is free and open to the public through August 2026. For more information, visit mmaa.org. For Minnesota Native News, I'm Deanna Standing Cloud.
Next, Travis Zimmerman talks to Minnesota Native News producer Dan Ninham about being inducted into the Minnesota Lacrosse Hall of Fame.
Oneida elder Dan Ninham and his wife Susan have been involved with Indigenous games for almost half a century. And lacrosse, known as the Creator's Game, has always been more than just a sport to Dan.
There's similar connections to a number of indigenous people throughout North America that believe that the Creator gave us the game to play for his amusement and for other reasons as well, anywhere from honoring people to helping with the healing process as a medicine game. That's all good medicine.
Dan has been an athlete most of his life, and he's been playing lacrosse for over 40 years.
I was a Oneida Tribal School K-8 physical education teacher for about 8 years. Soon after getting there in 83 or so, made the career commitment to Indigenous games and implemented that into the curriculum.
Dan feels like his greatest contribution has been growing the game and the number of Native children introduced to it.
We continue with that and have encouraged a number of other people throughout Minnesota, Ojibwe and Dakota communities, as well as urban communities, to play the wooden stick game and to play the modern stick game with cultural connections to the modern stick game.
Earlier this month, there was an awards banquet for the first inductees to the Minnesota Lacrosse Hall of Fame. Dan attended with his wife, Susan, and was honored for his contributions to reviving a game central to tribal identities in the past.
And it's nice to be recognized by my colleagues. I look at it as being an honor to be where I am the second. And it's not the end, it's just it's a continuance.
For Minnesota Native News, this is Travis Zimmerman.
That's all for this week's episode. Join us next time for more voices and stories that inform, uplift, and shape our communities right here on Minnesota Native News. Minnesota Native News is produced by AMPERS, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, made possible by funding from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and the citizens of Minnesota.
You can find more at minnesotanativenews.org. It is 6:36. Thanks for listening to the Monday Morning Show here on KAXC. I'm Jennifer Barr. Heidi Holton joins me now. Good morning.
Good morning. Beautiful morning with that sliver of moon out there, and as the sun is rising and chilly, but not freezing cold yet. So it feels kind of good, and it's a beautiful day. We're kind of going to be talking. I think we always talk about the weather, because we live here, and as the seasons change, we're always kind of noting what's different and what's going on, and that's what we're going to be talking about all week, as we always do. But we want to hear how you're dealing with this change in season. Are you getting cozier? Are you having some more cocoa at night? Do you say cocoa or hot chocolate?
I usually say hot chocolate, unless I want to feel fancy.
I know. Cocoa's cute,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
We want to know how you change when fall turns into winter. I brought some, went through closets and brought some stuff to donate over the weekend. That was sort of my thing. And I don't necessarily move out. I don't have enough that I need to completely change out closets or drawers into winter to summer. But
I don't have enough either, but I do have a separate, spot for the kind of the wintry stuff.
Yeah. Yep. And I last weekend made sure I got some new gloves. That's the first time I've done that. I decided instead of although I didn't wear them today, as I was driving, I was like, why didn't I wear those new gloves? It was a little chilly. But each year it seems like I forget that all of a sudden one day you're going to need gloves, and then I don't know where they are. I can only find one.
Mm-hmm.
And I just thought, I'm worth investing in gloves.
Yeah. I have a bench that has, storage for things like hats and gloves. And I went through that last weekend and, matched everything up, made sure everything had a match. And I kind of organized it from gloves you wear when it's not so cold to like the snow shoveling gloves. And then there's some socks and hats and
stuff
in there. So I felt very good organizing that.
Maybe that's something you do. Maybe it's the food you're eating. I've already done, I've been doing some hot dishes, tater tots and stuff like that.
I made chili over the weekend.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Nice.
Kind of made up my own recipe. We were not a chili eating family when I was young.
Yeah.
Because my dad and I didn't like, we just thought we didn't like it. We just didn't eat it. So I didn't think I liked it. But I like it when I make it.
Yeah. Beans?
Yep. Just black beans.
Okay.
And some fire roasted tomatoes. Some hamburger.
Fire.
Yeah.
Nice.
They weren't spicy. They just have that different kind of flavor. They come, they're just canned tomatoes, but they're the fire roasted kind.
Nice. That sounds good. I'm trying to remember. We went to some friends were hosting like a craft sale sort of thing, and one of them was doing baked goods. So we bought a big round of sourdough, homemade sourdough. So I've been toasting that with what we're having. And oh, I know, I made a I made spaghetti and meatballs, which I haven't done in a long time. That always feels kind of good. But we'd love to hear from you. What are the cozy things, or how do you getting ready? Maybe it's not cozy. I know Andrew is completely obsessed with car scraper. He wants a better one or the perfect one.
I have been meaning to tell him this, and I haven't yet, so I don't know if he's listening. But I remember
wake up, Andrew.
Our former engineer, Dan Haug, talked about brass ice scrapers.
We used to have a lot of stress here when it came to our staff meetings and when it was your turn to cook. Mm-hmm. And one time I traded him, I would make the food if I could get one of those scrapers.
Oh, yeah.
But I don't know where mine is.
Okay.
I probably sold it with the last car I had or something.
But yeah.
Yeah, so a brass scraper. Because, see, I need something on a stick because of the short arms. That's not an issue for Andrew.
Yeah. No. I know. I have like the extendable.
Oh, wow.
Like it, you know, can get longer, the snow brush.
I think the big question he always has is, do you leave it in your car all year long? It sounds like he gets a lot of business from his friends.
I do leave it in my car all year round.
Because
I will forget. But I do have a little shovel that actually my parents gave me as like part of my high school graduation.
Yeah.
Like they gave me all this little practical stuff.
Go out into the world, Jennifer.
So it's like this little shovel that also has like an extendable handle.
Sure.
And I do not keep that in my car all year round, but I put it in the back and
it's a great
idea. Hear it rattling around back there all the time now, and it kind of annoys me, but it's like, I might need it.
It just dawned on me that if you're tuning in right now, you may think we're going to be getting a blizzard or something.
No.
We're not. It's going to be 38 to 42 today, and we'll see some sun. It's going to be pretty out there, but we're just thinking about as winter approaches, and partly cloudy tonight, low 17 to 25, highs in the low 40s tomorrow, mostly sunny, and then about 40 on Wednesday, cloudy skies. Slight chance of rain in the afternoon.
Yeah. Yeah, we've just been talking about those changes that we go through as winter approaches. And
We want to hear from you, maybe a recipe, 218-326-1234. Text that number. We'd love to hear from you this Monday morning.
Coming up about an hour from now, we're going to have a new installment of What We're Reading with our staff librarian, Tammy Bobrowski. Today, she's talking with Minnesota novelist Will Weaver. He's got a follow-up to his previous book, Power and Light, which followed the Haugen family. This one's called Black Dirt, Bright Stars. Excited to hear all about that.
Yeah, we were big fans of Power and Light and this family that was fending for themselves. And they were kind of on by the Red River, right? On the edge of Minnesota, North Dakota, Minnesota, farmers. Yep. And I'm excited to hear this conversation and excited to get my hands on that book.
Yes. It'll
be fun.
Support for KAXE comes from Sanford Health with primary care locations in Bemidji and across the upper Midwest. Sanford Health is committed to providing care close to home. Learn more at sanfordhealth.org. Up next, we're going to hear Laura Erickson speaking for the birds.
In 1983, National Geographic added a brand new field guide to the two standards of the time, the Peterson and Golden Guides. The new Field Guide to the Birds of North America combined the best features of both. So the moment I got my copy, it ousted my trusty Golden Guide as my constant companion in the field, despite it being more than 70% heavier to lug around. As good as the National Geographic Guide was, bird names change. Their ranges expand and shrink, and the more we learn, the more we find out how much we still need to learn, and the more we keep on learning. It's hard and expensive to revise field guides, but they don't stay current long. No other field guide gets updated more than every decade or two, but in the 42 years since the first edition came out, National Geographic has updated and revised their field guide 7 times, averaging a new edition every 6 years. I don't collect field guides. I just buy the ones I'm likely to refer to when I need quick information. But I get emotionally bonded to field guides that have been with me for a while, including every edition of the National Geographic. So I've been keeping the 1st through the 6th editions in an easily accessible spot on the bookshelf closest to my desk, and the 7th on my desk where I can grab it whenever I need. When the new 8th edition was recently released, I, of course, immediately ordered it. This is called the 8th edition, but it's the first National Geographic field guide to bear a new title, Field Guide to Birds of the United States and Canada, because it now includes the birds of Hawaii. It has the same number of pages as the 7th edition, but is a full inch taller and half an inch wider, meaning it won't fit on the same shelf as my other field guides. My Sibley Guide to Birds is too tall for that shelf too, but I use it too much to set it anywhere else, so I turned it spine up. I expected I'd put the new National Geographic field guide on my desk, replacing the 7th edition, but the text font is too small for me to comfortably read, even with my reading glasses, and the text boxes describing each family are green with white text, way too low contrast for my aging eyes. So my 7th edition stays in the place of honor on my desk, and the 8th is going over with my occasionally consulted reference books. I'm rather surprised that National Geographic made the font so small. My Sibley guide happens to be the first printing of the 2nd edition, the text smaller and paler than it should be, too. But there was such an outcry when it was released by both older people and also young people with vision issues that the publishers quickly issued a 2nd printing and exchanged copies for those who were distressed with the first one. I couldn't see wasting paper and fossil fuels to exchange mine when I only consult it at home when I'm wearing reading glasses. That tiny font is still more readable than the font in the new National Geographic guide, and Sibley did not use low-contrast text boxes that hurt my eyes. The author of the new edition, Ted Floyd, is an editor at the American Birding Association, famous for his interest in making birding more popular among young people. He understands that the internet is where young people get most of their information now. It also happens to be where I get most of my information. The reference I use more than any other is Cornell's Birds of the World, which is only available online. With the evolution of so many online resources and apps, I was surprised that Ted Floyd got involved with this field guide project at all, but assumed it would come with a companion app. I may be an elderly, old-fashioned birder and a field guide author myself, but I can't remember the last time I brought a field guide into the field except the Kaufman Field Guide to Nature of the Midwest when I'm out with Walter or other non-monomaniacal people who are curious about way more than just birds. It would be hard for National Geographic to compete with Cornell's Merlin and eBird apps, which are free for anyone and constantly being updated, or with the Sibley Birds V2 app. That one may seem a little pricey at $19.99, but it's worth every penny. It includes all the illustrations and information from the 2nd edition of his field guide, which lists at $45, plus it includes recordings of just about every species. It's wonderfully easy to use and sets a standard of excellence none of the other American field guide apps that I've tried ever approached. And believe it or not, I can use any of these 3 apps on my phone in the field without my reading glasses. When the American Birding Association started including Hawaii in their official ABA area in 2016, I was thrilled. So many of the native species of our island state are threatened or endangered, and helping them is the responsibility of every one of us Americans. But if you're looking for birds in Hawaii, 2,500 miles from the mainland, why on earth would you lug around and search through a 592-page tome weighing more than 2 pounds to find a bird that can be looked up in Hawaii Audubon's fully inclusive field guide, Hawaii's Birds, which is only 160 pages and weighs barely half a pound? Much of the information Ted Floyd provides is superb, and this new National Geographic Field Guide got very good reviews from a lot of excellent birders I respect. I've already referred to it twice on recent programs when showing the range expansion of the Black Phoebe and Western Cattle Egret over recent decades. But field guides are supposed to help us figure out what bird we're looking at in the moment, and this one is too unwieldy and, for me, unreadable to serve that purpose. John Dunn and Jonathan Alderfer, the two listed authors on the 5th, 6th, and 7th editions of the National Geographic Field Guide, also edited National Geographic's superb Complete Birds of North America, a 4.5-pound reference book that includes the artwork from the field guide and much more, going way beyond identification. It is much too huge to serve as any kind of a field guide, but I think this new one is too. I wish Ted Floyd had written it not as the 8th edition of the Field Guide, but as an updated and expanded 4th edition of National Geographic's Complete Birds of North America. I'm Laura Erickson, speaking for the birds.
Chickadee-dee-dee. You can find more from Laura Erickson at her website, lauraerickson.com. Do you have a favorite bird guide?
Me?
Well, anybody.
So, yeah. we have a bunch of them sitting around because it's really nice to be able to take a look. Even though there's Merlin, you know, that helps a lot. It's nice to be able to look it up. And like, for instance, we have this, we think we saw the last of this Wilson snipe that's been on the shoreline.
Oh.
And it's been digging down. I found out that it eats invertebrates. So it's digging in the sand.
Interesting.
And, yeah, it's got this long beak that's kind of like a tool, it feels like, you know? We talked about it on the last Season Watch podcast. And even the chickadee-dee-dee-dee, like if they do 4 D's, it means there's some peril.
Oh, yeah.
If there's too many. Like, I didn't know this stuff.
I heard that, yes.
So, yeah, we've been talking a lot about what's out there and what in the field guides help a lot. I think once you start getting curious, you kind of want to find out, like, well, where do they go? Where do they end up? Because we end up getting some birds that are coming from way north and they end up landing here and staying here. But
yeah,
things change
a lot.
What
their ranges.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. It's the Monday Morning Show on KAXE. I'm Jennifer Barr with Heidi Holton, and support comes from Paul Bunyan Communications, powered by the GigaZone Broadband Cooperative, featuring all fiber optic GigaZone internet speeds up to 10 gig and local customer service. Learn more at paulbunyan.net.
We would also like to thank North in Bloom in downtown Grand Rapids, providing floral arrangements for all occasions and holidays throughout the year. Also offering wedding consultations, flower subscriptions, and gift sets. More information at northinbloom.com.
We continue now with Morning Edition.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. We have an update this morning on the story of a researcher at Cornell University who is developing an artificial heart for babies and toddlers.
It's about the size of a AA battery, and it's so close to being used to save lives and children.
James Antaki was among the researchers who had their federal grants canceled by the Trump administration as it tried to impose its power on universities.
We feel like collateral damage.
And then Cornell became the third elite college to make a deal with the administration over claims of anti-Semitism and accusations that diversity programs are racial discrimination. NPR's Alyssa Nadworny brings us up to date.
I spoke to James Antaki a few days after he got the email officially restarting decades of work on the Pediaflow, an implantable artificial heart.
I think the overwhelming reaction was this relief and maybe disbelief.
Antaki's grant was among about $250 million in federal grants restored after Cornell made a deal with the White House, formally accepting the administration's interpretation of civil rights laws. Part of the deal requires the Ivy League school to pay the government $30 million and also invest $30 million in agriculture over the next 3 years. Now the rebuilding has to begin, which Antaki says is daunting.
Every time I feel sorry for myself, I have to catch myself and say, this is not about me. It's so much bigger than me.
About 1 in 100 babies in the U.S. are born with congenital heart defects. Antaki's device would help young kids with the most serious conditions, like Caleb, the 4-year-old boy and his mom, Nora Strickland, that we met in our original story. I called them to share the news.
Dr. Antaki's grant was unfrozen.
Oh my God, are you serious? Wow, I just got goosebumps.
This renews her hope for families like hers. Caleb is on an artificial heart called a VAD, awaiting a transplant at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. Caleb's VAD hangs outside his skinny little body, and it has to be plugged into the wall, meaning he and his family can't go home.
How is Caleb doing in general?
He's good. He's doing really well. Doesn't let the VAD keep him from being him.
She sends me a video of Caleb building a volcano with magna tiles.
We're going to have another mini volcano. Record the eruption.
All right.
Whoa! He knocks the creation over. Later, Nora tells Caleb the news of Antaki's grant.
How does it make you feel that you changed the course of medical history?
Good?
Yeah.
Should they change, like, the world or something?
You did, Bubby. Because one day, kids aren't going to have to stay in the hospital when they have a VAD. One day, they're going to have a VAD that they can go home on.
They don't keep me playing video games.
Yeah, I'm just really proud of you.
Back in Ithaca, New York, Dr. Antaki has a long road ahead. He has to rehire a team, line up a manufacturer for the prototype, and then prepare to test the pump in animals. Alyssa Nadworny, NPR News.
The number of memory care units for people with dementia in the U.S. has grown 62% over the past decades. In them, residents are often kept behind locked doors. A movement to make this kind of living less segregated is getting traction, as Ashley Milne-Tite reports.
A few years ago, Janice Rogers of Belchertown, Massachusetts, made a decision many adult children dread. Her mother, Rita, was then 91, living alone, and her health was going downhill.
I didn't feel I could take care of my mom, which is an awful thing to say. I felt I needed to put her somewhere.
The first facility she chose didn't work out. Today, her mom lives in a retirement community called Loomis Lakeside at Reed's Landing in Springfield, Massachusetts. Rogers is visiting her mother for a game of bingo.
That's a good number, Ma. Thank you. G60.
Rita has dementia, but there is no secure memory care unit here for people like her. She can walk around the facility as much or as little as she likes, including going outside, which suits her daughter just fine.
She sees freedom, but she's okay. To have a locked door? That wouldn't go well with her.
Laurie Todd is executive director of Loomis Lakeside at Reed's Landing. She says people sometimes try to leave locked memory care units because they feel confined. Here, she says, they want those with dementia to live the best life they can in community.
What we do is meet them where they are and work with the other residents to teach them how to be good neighbors. So we're not isolating them, just as we wouldn't isolate people that all had congestive heart failure or diabetes.
Todd says they train staff and residents on how to interact with someone with dementia, like how to calm the person if they're upset. Brenda Mendoza is life enrichment and memory care director here. She says when residents have questions about this approach, she'll meet with them.
And talk a little bit about why we do it, what's the benefit, and how would you feel, and putting yourself in their shoes. Like, that's how I want to be treated if I'm ever here.
Not every resident gets on board, she and Todd say, but many do. Still, the thought of being without a locked memory care unit is off-putting to some who worry about safety. Arnie Barish is a former podiatric surgeon who was diagnosed with dementia at 62.
I describe it like hitting a wall doing about 200 miles an hour.
That was 10 years ago. Barish lives at home with his wife in Michigan, but knows he could live elsewhere at some point.
I believe in locked memory care units. And my reason for that is I believe it is more of a safety factor for the patient with dementia.
He's not alone. Many family members feel a locked door is the best way to ensure their loved one doesn't leave the facility and potentially get lost. Kirsten Jacobs gets that. She's with Leading Age, a network of organizations that serves older adults.
We all want safety for our loved ones. And as the individual, we want autonomy.
She says the trick is to find the balance between risk and the dignity of the person with dementia. She says if you go back a few decades to a common practice in nursing homes.
We used to tie people up, and that was in the name of safety. We've learned that wasn't the safest approach, and now that's not a model that we follow.
Arnie Barish says no matter where people with dementia live,
the major thing is we still need to be treated as a person.
Because even if the disease is advanced, he says that person is still there. For NPR News, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite.